Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for graduation and Father's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
City 90.5 WKAR and current state. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us here on Monday. It's our first June broadcast ever. Our first ever during the week, anyway. The Lansing City Council could try to overturn Mayor Virge Bernero's veto of the council's 2014 budget tonight. Later this hour on Current State, Lansing-based pianist Sergei Kovitko on a career milestone. He walked out on the stage of Carnegie Hall about 10 days ago, and we're going to talk with him about that experience. And the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta has had more of Mackinac Island than probably all the rest of us put together here. He's been up there for the last 4 or 5 days or so, covering the Mackinac Policy Conference and the Governor's Council gathering on the Great Lakes, and he stops by here in a little bit to tell us about that. At the top of the show today, a small group of grassroots activists has gotten behind an effort to alter the map here in Lansing. It's established a social media effort specifically to dissolve Lansing Township. Joshua Pugh launched a Facebook page recently with that name. Josh and some others, including Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero, claims the township model is outdated and does not serve the region's needs. Joining me to explain the whys and wherefores of his movement is organizer and Lansing Township resident Joshua Pugh. Josh, nice to see you.
Morning, Mark.
And joining in, Larry Merrill, executive director of the Michigan Townships Association, who will also offer his views. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Mark.
I want to make clear that Current State spoke with Kathy Rogers, Lansing Township Supervisor, about joining the conversation. She declined. So, Josh, you don't want to live in Lansing Township, but you don't want to move.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You put it in very stark terms there, Mark. I like it.
Well, go ahead and take us through your case for dissolving Lansing Township. Why is that a
Absolutely.
Good idea?
Well, I think what this comes down to is really establishing a new culture, a new solution-oriented way of doing things for the Mid-Michigan region. What I found as I've started this is the debate has kind of boiled down, like a lot of debates do in local politics in the Mid-Michigan region, and that's very personality-oriented and very petty, I think, and not focused on ways that we can all work together to do things better for the region. I'll say out front, I understand it's a radical solution, and so a lot of people can be kind of taken aback by it at mm-hmm. first. But I really think that it's fair to say that we should just start a discussion about ways that we can do things better for
okay.
the area.
Are you specifically an advocate of the township becoming a part of the city of Lansing?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And Larry Merrill of the MTA, what do you make of this movement?
Well, I think it's always fair for people to talk about government, local government, structure, boundaries, you know, none of this is divinely inspired, but it is not only radical, it's probably got an uphill battle. It's going to be tough to convince people that, A, your township government should be dissolved and instead Mayor Bernero and the city council should be governing you. You should be paying taxes that are probably double what you're paying right now for local services. Your police department, your fire department should be dissolved. Your water system also done away with. And you should be paying legacy costs for those Lansing employees who retired decades ago and the city has unfunded legacy costs for. That will be a tough sell.
Josh, it is true that you are proposing becoming a part of a municipality with chronic budget deficits, and Mayor Bernero himself and others fear Lansing could be under an emergency manager in 5 years or so. He's actually gone on the record and said that. Why would you advocate for connecting with that?
Sure. Well, it's interesting that Larry brought up the water system, because in fact Lansing still takes the township sewage, and the reason it's impractical for a municipality with just 8,000 people and spread out over five non-contiguous areas to set up a system like that for sewage treatment, and this is kind of an example of regional problem solving. What happened in the 1980s? There was a real change here, and that's when immediately after the Clean Water Act was passed. They had to find a new way of disposing of the stormwater because the city said we can't take it anymore. And what happened was I live right across from Fairview Park and the toll gate drain there and the golf course. And the city and the county actually stepped up and said, okay, how can we work together in a regional way to put this stormwater and to filter it and to find a sustainable way of doing things? But the township never would have been able to do it by itself. And so we see that... a lot of times these townships aren't able to, they don't have the same obligations as these cities, and they get kind of, the city of Lansing is taking this sewage and because it's impractical for the township to do that. So in a lot of ways, township residents are kind of getting a free ride. So this is a way of bringing everyone to the table and saying, okay, how can we all be stakeholders and how can we work together as a region?
What about situations like that, Larry?
Well, sure, but I don't know why we use the term free riding, because those water sewers contracts are not free services. They are fee for services, and typically the rates that cities charge for their non-resident water sewer systems are much higher than what they charge their own residents. So when local units of government work together like they're supposed to and collaborate where it makes sense, it doesn't necessarily mean, therefore, all local government from the governing structure ought to be dissolved and all other services go away. Some things, as Josh pointed out, water, sewer, are among the few services that local governments provide where there are true economies of scale. For most of the labor-intensive services, including fire protection, law enforcement, and most of the other things, the larger you make your unit of government, the higher the per capita cost. It's actually diseconomies of scale. And the proof of that is just look at the millage rates. Look at the taxes that people pay. The larger the unit of government, the higher the tax rates are.
Is Lansing Township a member of your association?
Yeah.
They are. Okay. How much of this, I mean, you mentioned the geography here, Josh, and it is pretty dramatic. Describe the geography of Lansing Township.
Well, sure, and I want to make it clear, this is not an assault on the township system as a whole. I think there are legitimate criticisms, but that's not necessarily what I'm raising here today. I think there are a number of reasons that Lansing Township is not your typical township. The first is what you said, the geography. It's five non-contiguous areas. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to register to vote in person, I would have to drive through a number of zip codes just to get to my clerk's office, my township clerk's office, because they're all disconnected and they're all over. And because what happened was when these townships were laid up, it was laid out as a 6x6 square, like every other township across the state, and then gradually it was kind of carved away, and so this is just what we have left. Another reason, though, is the debt load. At the bottom of the recession, we had the township acting as a developer and going into Eastwood Town Center when no other private developers would, and taking on this project that no private developers would take on. So they took it on, and finally it looks like we're seeing some sort of progress on that. But what that means is they're now, as property values have declined every year since 2006 in the township, they're now past the threshold. They can't borrow anymore. So we've got the Leaseway motor car site out on the west side that was dependent on those GM plants. And so when those GM plants went under, this business went under. And so now we have a vacant site there, and they applied to the state for a brownfield loan so they could redevelop it. And the state said, no, you're past your threshold. So this is where we see this local government, this municipality, is just over-leveraged.
Aren't there opportunities for much greater economies of scale, certainly in circumstances like this, Larry?
Well, probably not in terms of economic development. Those tend to be pretty specific. But there is opportunities for collaboration, in terms of provisions of services. But I'm glad to hear Josh say that this isn't an indictment on the township system in general. When you described his website to me on the phone, you indicated that he said as his premise that townships were obsolete or archaic or some term such as that. And in fact, the truth is that we tend to be very economical. The township form of government is now the government of choice. Over 50% of Michigan's population is governed by townships, and we govern 96% of Michigan's 58,000 square miles. So it isn't really going to go away, but it's proven to be very economical. People like it, and people like the sense of grassroots connection of having some ownership of their local unit of government. And the problem with the five areas, well, you know, that's true, but it's not a situation that Lansing Township created. It was a situation that Lansing, City of Lansing, created by carving out, by annexing only those portions that had high tax value and avoiding those areas where there was strong opposition and would have required a public vote. Those same areas now, I guess, are being asked to reconsider whether they're going to join into the City of Lansing. Historically, they've been very, very resistant to that for many of the reasons I think I outlined earlier.
What about that particular piece of history here from the City of Lansing, Josh?
Well, you know, I don't think anyone's questioning that. Again, the township system works very well for these rural areas and for areas where it's kind of operating as it was meant to since the 18th century when this was conceived. But for more urban areas, I mean, you look at the partnership between Lansing and East Lansing, sharing a fire chief. You look at in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor, the firemen's unions there have both indicated that they're open to more regional sharing of services and collaboration. I think that it's time to kind of have a conversation about this.
But even in more metropolitan areas, you know, I'm glad Josh is conceding the township form works in rural areas. But here, let's take Delhi Township, one that I'm a little more familiar with. You know, their cost per capita for fire protection is $75 compared to the City of Lansing's $250. So what is it about Delhi Township that isn't working and working well?
Josh, what do you mean this? I mean, on your Facebook page, it does, I think, specifically say that the township model is outdated. You want to clarify that?
In this specific case, I would say.
According to a really interesting City Pulse story by Andy Belaskovitz from late last year, a consolidation like this has really been pulled off only one time in Michigan history since the State Boundary Commission was formed back in 1968. Three small towns in the UP, Iron River, Stambaugh, and Mineral Hills, with a combined population of 3,500.
And none of them a township.
None of them a township, yes, that's clear. Merged on July 1st, 2000. It has been attempted, but it's failed since in other jurisdictions over the past 20 years. Larry, is there a precedent? This has not happened with townships, then, that you're aware of.
Well, actually, maybe there is one example in Battle Creek Township, where Kellogg basically put a gun to the community's head and said, we're going to take our corporate headquarters somewhere else and take all of thousands of jobs with it if the city of Battle Creek and Battle Creek Township didn't merge. That was in 1982, and that might be the better example of what Josh is referring to. But that took special legislation, was more of what was called a merger of equals. It wasn't really, but that's what it was billed as. What this would really be is, what is being advocated here is that Lansing Township would just simply be taken over by the City of Lansing. And for that, there really is no precedent for that other than whole townships used to incorporate as cities, and that hasn't happened since 1981.
Mayor Bernero has been a pretty strong proponent of what you believe in here. Josh, what's his contact been with your group, and have you discussed this with him?
I've had absolutely no contact with him, believe it or not. You know, but I think what you just pointed out, what that illustrates is that it's a real uphill struggle to do this in state law. The procedure is laid out, and I think intentionally so that we can have input from everybody that's involved. And I think what that says is that this isn't, you know, a power grab. This isn't something that the mayor's going to be able to force through or anything like that. This is a really long, really fair and democratic process.
It's a long, ongoing discussion. You know what? We've been talking about this for a while already, and it's not the discussion's not going away. I think that much we can all agree on. Joshua Pugh is a Lansing Township resident and has launched the Facebook page Dissolve Lansing Township. Larry Merrill is executive director of the Michigan Michigan Townships Association. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Mark.
Our pleasure.
That's Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, played by the Lansing-based pianist, composer, and producer Sergei Kvitko. It's one of the pieces he played back on May 23rd during his Carnegie Hall debut. And Sergei joins us now in the studio to tell us about what the experience was like to play that esteemed venue, which is no doubt a career highlight for any professional musician. Nice to see you, Sergei.
Good to see you too, Mark.
What was it like to first walk out on the stage?
I can't describe it. It's awesome. It's stressful, and it's just wonderful. It is a career highlight.
It's a lot of the stress that you would associate with an important performance, but
yes,
just dialed up a couple of degrees. Is that it?
But at the same time, you know, I've done so many of these recitals in preparation for the Carnegie recital,
right,
that one part of me says, well, it's just another hall. It's really beautiful. It's a gorgeous piano, but at the same time, you know, in the middle of playing, you realize it's Carnegie Hall.
Was staying focused a challenge?
Not really. I was focused.
Now, the series of concerts that led up to it,
mm-hmm,
did those all include the same program,
yes,
that you played?
Yes.
So that was that, in a way, was a kind of a tactical decision.
Yes, absolutely.
To just internalize the program.
Absolutely.
So that you could control your emotions maybe a little bit better? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. How did the show itself go? How long did you play?
It's altogether about an hour and a half, an hour and 20 minutes, something like that.
Okay.
Wonderful audience. I did not expect, you know, I thought, you know, New Yorkers would be a little less enthusiastic about some outsider, but it was a wonderful, from the very second I walked on the stage, I felt this, you know, love and acceptance from the audience. That was really wonderful. So, and after the first piece, when I heard the applause, and so that was great. That was very pleasant.
How analyze your performance for us that night, and how much from night to night does your performance vary? Do you feel like you nail it? You nail it some nights, and you're definitely not in your game others?
I don't think I had in the entire tour, I don't think I ever had an off night. I think they were just, but they're all very different because I feel differently, so I play differently. Sometimes the tempos are a little faster, sometimes they're slower. It's really hard to tell. But the one at Carnegie, I think my plan of getting ready and kind of climbing that mountain worked, and I think my performance at Carnegie was the best out of the entire tour.
Oh, no kidding.
I'm sure.
What was that 30 to 60 minutes like before you took the stage?
That's the worst time always.
Yeah.
That's why you feel kind of so alone at the same time. I don't want to see anybody, and at the same time, I want to distract myself from obsessing about what's going to happen. And at Carnegie, it's a little more complicated because, you know, there are three different halls in the building. So it's an entire block of concert halls. There are three concert halls, the large and the medium one and the smaller one, the Weill Recital Hall where I played.
Okay.
And so when you walk in, it's like a factory. There's something going on at every hall, and the hall, it's all so beautifully organized, and something happens in any green room or the concert stage at any given time, and these people move around. It's really kind of fascinating in a way. So I just feel like a humbling experience because I feel like a little piece of that puzzle that they put together every single day. So that was interesting.
A cog in the machine.
Right.
Is that
right.
It? What was your favorite piece to perform at in this program?
Was it pictures? Was it
probably one of the others? Probably the picture is the most gratifying because you know it is such a bear, such a monster, and after you complete it, it's like completing this huge journey. And when you hear the audience's reaction, and you know, I didn't realize how much people screamed bravos and everything until I actually watched the tape because I was a little in the zone when it all happened and ended. But it was really overwhelming.
Tell us about the string of performances. You've been playing this program for how long?
For about since January, so for about 5 months.
And you toured throughout the Midwest?
Right, right. Well, I ventured a little bit in the South, in South Carolina and Louisiana. Okay. As well as Missouri, Illinois, Tennessee.
Okay. You know. Does performing at Carnegie Hall feel like an end point in any sense, since it's such a milestone?
I actually was considering it to be my final recital and just, you know, climbing that mountain, getting it done and getting it over with.
Understood.
And moving on.
Understood.
But now I feel like I want to do more. So I'm making more plans.
Is it more comfortable to be joined on stage by others, or does the added component of another musician increase the stress of a performance?
Usually, it depends, and it depends on who joins you on the stage. I was joined not by musicians, by the dancers, and they make the show so much more unique, and at the same time, they make it much more stressful. Because I have a responsibility for them, was the choreography and everything. You know, when I'm playing by myself, I'm responsible for myself. But when they're on the stage,
sure.
And I mess something up, they're in trouble too. So that was an added stress.
That 90-minute window. Take us through that. Was there a breakthrough period where the stress level went down noticeably for you?
You mean during the performance itself?
Yeah. Once you actually started playing, how did your emotions and were you able to be in the moment more, say, an hour into the performance than you were 5 minutes into the performance?
No, it's the entire thing is just one flight. You just take off and you fly, and then you land at the end.
Okay.
That's just.
Remind us the pieces that you performed.
Well, I played three of my own transcriptions, the Bach's Prelude in C Major with a few added notes, which is a really fun piece, and people really like it, and I start with it. And then I played my transcription of Isai's Violin Sonata for solo piano, which is a first of its kind. And
where did you get the inspiration to tackle that?
Just wanted to do something. Well, the Isai I wrote actually quite a few years ago.
Okay.
Yes, many years ago, just out of curiosity, I just wanted to see how that works. So, and then Bach was a more recent piece that I did, and I did another transcription of one of Mussorgsky's songs, Tripak, from Songs and Dances of Death, which is also very unusual. And that was one of the ideas to attract more people, especially in New York, when they've seen it all, but they have never heard this. Arrangements. And so that might have been the reason there were so many people at the concert hall.
You taking a breather now, or are you trying to capitalize on the energy generated from playing at Carnegie Hall? What's next?
Well, I playing piano doesn't make any money for me, so and I have to make a living. So, and the recordings got a little bit backed up and postponed, so now it's... every single day scheduled for almost the entire summer.
Producing
and recording and editing and mastering and getting CDs out.
In the West Side neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
That's nice. Sergei Kavitko is a Lansing pianist, composer, and producer. On May 23rd, he made his debut at Carnegie Hall. Sergei, thanks for joining me to talk about such a thrilling highlight in your career.
Thank you, Mark.
Stay tuned, there's more after the news on Current State.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, hosting the annual Grub Crawl on Tuesday, June 11th, starting at 5 in the Eastwood Town Center. Details and wristbands available at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It is Monday, June 3rd. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. No sooner had conferees wrapped up last week's Mackinac Policy Conference than another gathering formed. A meeting might break out at any moment. For the first time in about 6 years, the Council of Great Lakes Governors met to discuss the economy and the environment. According to the group's website, the conference included a particular focus on trade, transportation, and water, and noted troll Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network attended the governor's conference.
That's right. I never crossed the bridge, and I will point out that at the chamber conference, I did successfully avoid the vodka luge.
Okay. That's curious. Well, it raises the question, do people on Mackinac Island refer to people who live in the lower peninsula as trolls, or is it just a UP thing?
I don't know. I'm married to a Youper, and real Youpers do not consider Mackinac Island really a part of the the UP. I shouldn't say real Youpers, but people who live on mainland UP see it as a place for hangers-on to go and sort of dip their toe.
Exactly. Who attends the Council of Great Lakes Governors event?
Well, in this particular event, there hadn't been one like this in half a dozen years, but it was about half the governors, four of the eight Great Lakes states, plus the premier of Quebec. The Canadian provinces are invited, and they're sort of ex officio members, and then they show up and they're granted voting privileges. But also a lot of NGOs, the Canadian and U.S. ambassador, the Canadian ambassador to the U.S. and the U.S. ambassador to Canada were there. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, who was an Illinois congressman, also showed up. Environmental groups, business groups, tourism promotion groups, you know.
What finally triggered the group to meet again, and what caused the 5 or 6 years where they didn't meet?
There were a few things. It's kind of speculative, but one of them was that perhaps the political makeup of the governors and the premiers, that for a while in Ontario there was a socialist in government there, and so there's a sense that maybe. This just wasn't a group that was going to coalesce, and just people's attentions were elsewhere. And Rick Snyder kind of has this vision of Michigan being the center of a regional economy.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from the Midwest up to Montreal in Canada. So, and he's the co-chair of the council this year. So it sort of makes sense that he would look at that and then go, this is a group that's got to get together and talk. Usually they talk about controversies, and the controversies are typically centered on environmental questions like invasive species and water diversion, where and how you might allow it. And this really, especially at the outset, it started out with a behind-closed-doors talk from Bill Ford, the chair of the Ford Motor Company, who's also tried to incorporate environmentalism into his business operation. And there was this idea that green technology and the fact that we've got the world's largest supply of the largest supply of surface fresh water in the world, mm-hmm. that's an opportunity. And so there are a lot of emerging industries that are coming out involving water filtration, how to move water from one place to another. real industrial stuff that might offer some opportunities. That when we talk about environmentally efficient and friendly ways of transportation, that if you build a facility on the Great Lakes that feeds off of other facilities on the Great Lakes for your supply chain, that you can reduce costs, be more efficient, and more environmentally sure. friendly that way. So there was a lot of discussion about those sorts of things, that water technology is going to be huge in the 21st century, and this is a natural spot for that. And Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker made kind of an interesting point, that there's been a lot of coverage in recent weeks of natural disasters in other parts of the country, the, mm-hmm. the tornadoes in Oklahoma, for example.
Yeah.
And he said, all told, that this is, climate-wise, this is a pretty stable area. We don't have tornadoes. We don't have earthquakes. We don't have cataclysmic natural disasters here. The Detroit Lions are sort of their own separate category. but we don't have cataclysmic natural disasters here like we see in other parts of the country.
Yeah.
So if you're involved in, technology that requires a stable environment, like, information storage, that, the upper Midwest may be
– there's worse places to be.
Yeah, maybe the place for you. And so, a lot of the discussion, focused around that. And I think that's where they kind of wanted to keep it. And then the discussion turned to invasive species, and that's been a topic that's really pitted, Michigan, encircled by water, against Illinois and Indiana over the network of shipping canals that essentially wind up creating a direct route from the Mississippi River system, which is infested by Asian carp, which has just upturned the ecology of that watershed to the Great Lakes mm-hmm. via a single shipping canal in Chicago. And there's this big fear that the Asian carp is going to somehow make its way through that, into Lake Michigan. Michigan has actually gone to court to try and force Illinois to shut down that canal, and has always been resisted. And then Illinois Governor Pat Quinn sort of made everyone go, huh? When he said, ultimately, I think we are going to have to shut down that shipping canal and replace it with something else. And I think it can be a great big public works project that could create an awful lot of jobs. And
was the response?
Well, the environmentalists in the room, you could hear the you could hear the applause, and you could see Pat Quinn is a Democrat. I don't know if that's relevant to the discussion, but I'm going to point it out. And you could see a couple of Republicans, Scott Walker and especially Mike Pence of Indiana, sort of scratch the back of their heads. And Mike Pence afterwards came over to the reporters and made sure that we knew that in no way, shape, or form is Indiana, which moves about $1.9 billion worth of stuff through that, through that network, would they be in favor of that? That he just sees it as too disruptive. And what we really need to do is manage the progress of the carp, not
erect barriers to transportation.
Not completely dismantle and recreate the infrastructure that's there.
So does this idea have a lot more legs since Governor Quinn's statement?
Well, governors, this would be a very, very, very long-term project. And, governors typically serve 4 to 8 years. And so we'll see how influential that is. But, the people who favor this, this approach of actually, creating a physical seal between the Mississippi River system and Lake Michigan and the rest of the Great Lakes, were pretty heartened by it, because it's like now
they've got an important new ally.
Right. The governor of the state that's been resisting this has said, conceptually, we're on board.
I understand you will be reporting shortly on some news involving the wolf hunt in Michigan. Tell us about that.
Last week, the leaders of the five big Michigan Indian tribes in Michigan had a meeting, and they decided that they will take some legal action to try and block the hunt from taking place in November. They will argue. My guess would be that there is a process set up in the most recent treaty that deals with these sorts of things that would allow them first to go to mediation, then binding arbitration, and then, you know, take it to federal court if necessary. But they're going to say that the wolf hunt was not done, was not enacted by the state of Michigan in a scientific fashion as it's defined by this particular treaty. Hmm. And also it just doesn't respect their treaty rights, that the wolf in American Indian culture is a sacred creature, that the chair of the Sioux tribe of Chippewas, Aaron Payment, who I believe you're going to be talking with tomorrow.
That's right.
You know, says that their culture says that the fate of the wolf is entwined with the fate of the indigenous peoples, and so, you know, they respect that. The Department of Natural Resources' response to that is that the Indian tribes were consulted, and certainly they have every right to manage the wolf population as they see fit on tribal land, but the state of Michigan, you know, gets to manage the wolves as the state deems fit on state land.
We shall see, and we indeed will have Aaron Payman on Current State tomorrow. Lastly, before we let you leave Mackinac Island behind you for a while, what were some of your bigger takeaways from the Detroit Regional Chamber Conference last week?
I mean, probably the biggest one was how this conference was really almost wholly focused on education. And a lot of that was because there are current debates in the legislature about what to do about the Common Core standards for measuring student achievement, you know, what to do about, you know, vocational education, you know, versus, you know, channeling people into four-year degrees and things like that. And so that was really the big topic was, you know, the future of education and also the future of education in urban areas where they're struggling. And of course, that bleeds out all across the state because we have at least 50 school districts that are on the state's list of places that are financially challenged.
Do meaningful conversations between state legislators with the potential impact on the state budget and big issues, do they take place at the Mackinac Policy Conference?
I don't know if they take place between legislators, but it is a place where, you know, the big money people who handle, millions of dollars in philanthropy and also, you know, quite bluntly, campaign contributions, can sit down with them and say, this is what, you know, we'd like to see happen. And a lot of this is actually, one of the things I noticed is that a lot of this event was built around Governor Snyder, you know, some people from some big foundations trying to convince the business community to get on board with, you know, the Education Achievement Authority in you know, the Detroit Public Schools, for example, and become engaged with that. And then once that happens, hoping that will also influence policymaking in Lansing.
And was that part of the reason Michelle Rhee and Jeb Bush also were keynote speakers at
yes.
this event?
Absolutely. I mean, that was not that was not an accident. It was supposed to be a focus. It wound up being almost the focus, again, just because of those controversies. And you had both Michelle Rhee and Jeb Bush sort of, you know, lob some darts at the legislature for dragging their feet on Common Core, because the legislature is saying, you know, we shouldn't be involving ourselves in this sort of federalized system of education standards. And the response is like, well, wait a second, you know, it may be national in the sense that 46 states have adopted it, and you know, everyone is trying to use the same metrics, but this wasn't developed in D.C. This was developed by the governors. This was developed by, you know, school officials from all across the country in lieu of creating a national federal standard.
Right. Rick Pluta is our Capitol correspondent for the Michigan Public Radio Network. You hear him regularly here on WKAR. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks a lot for joining us. Last week, the rather shocking news broke of a Flint woman who was killed while fighting in Syria. According to Syrian state television, 33-year-old Nicole Mansfield was killed by government forces on May 29th while fighting alongside anti-government rebels in the northwestern city of Idlib. Investigators and the family are still trying to ascertain how she got there and what motivated her to leave Michigan to fight in Syria's bloody two-year civil war in which at least 80,000 people have been killed. Here to help put Nicole Mansfield's situation in some perspective, we thought we'd look back at the long history of foreign fighters, and here to help us is David Mallett. He's a lecturer in international relations at the University of Melbourne and the author of the just-published book, Foreign Fighters, Transnational Identity in Civil Conflicts. He joins us by phone from Australia. Hello, David.
Morning. How are you?
We are well. Thanks very much for joining us. Does Nicole Mansfield's profile sound familiar?
You know, it actually does sound familiar if you look at individuals who became foreign fighters in a number of different conflicts over the last couple hundred years. Recent conflicts like Iraq and Somalia that the Americans went to go fight in, but also historical ones like the Spanish Civil War. They tend to be individuals who are somehow socially dislocated or sometimes even economically. A large number tend to be from broken homes, like Nicole Mansfield was, sometimes from immigrant groups. And they're not loners. They're very active within some sort of religious or ethnic or political subculture, some sort of organization, which is typically where the recruiters find them. But they're marginalized within their broader national society. So the recruiters are able to make the pitch that they have some sort of duty to the group, that their group is under threat. Forget your country of citizenship, which is easy for them to do if they're socially marginalized. And, you know, their ties to these groups, whatever they happen to be, whether they're Islam or, in historical cases, communism or ethnic groups, is sort of both the how and the why of recruitment.
How much have you looked into Nicole Mansfield's life?
Yeah, I've read what everybody else has read in the papers the last few days. It sounds like, you know, her parents split up when she was little, that she was raised by grandparents, that she perhaps, you know, had some difficulties as a teenager, which seems to be a common pattern here, and at some point found a new religion, converted, had been trying to become more involved in issues affecting the global Islamic community, global Muslim community, and somehow, we don't know the full details, but somehow this was enough for her to go and fight on behalf of Sunni Muslims against the Assad regime.
How far back in history have you looked at this phenomenon of foreign fighters?
Well, in the book, I go back the last 200 years to 1816. But you can find some cases further back, the French who fought in the American Revolution. But the data really begins to crystallize, I think, in the middle of the 19th century. The first case I look at in great depth that we have a lot of material available for to study recruitment and volunteers was the Texas Revolution in the 1830s. And there were actually more Europeans fighting at the Alamo than there were Texans. And you had a couple of thousands of people from the U.S., and Texas was part of Mexico at the time, who came in the name of defending liberal democracy in Mexico. And when that appeal didn't really get as many volunteers as the recruiters wanted, they shifted it to a racial frame that white Anglo-Saxon Protestants had to defend their countrymen, you know, settlers against Hispanic Catholics. So, you know, the rationale changes. Recruiters are strategic, and if they're not getting the response they look for, they will say it's a different group that's threatened. They'll even invent identities, like the anti-fascist sort of umbrella identity created in the Spanish Civil War to bring in Democrats, Unionists, Jews, African-Americans, anybody who might conceivably be threatened by fascism.
Did an awful lot of people who fit that description fight in the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, there were probably 50,000 or so foreign volunteers on the communist or democratic side in the Spanish Civil War.
Wow.
3,000 Americans, probably the best guesses. Large-scale mobilization and active recruitment infrastructure. You usually don't get individuals going off by themselves. It's really doubtful that Nicole Mansfield would have just made her own way to Syria and wandered into, you know, a battle zone. You find training camps, even fake travel agencies set up in the United States in some of these historical cases. You have fundraising efforts. Even in the 1980s, there were fake sales for jihad across the U.S. for you know, the Afghan insurgency. In the 1940s, a Broadway star, Marlon Brando, set up to fund the recruitment of American Jews to go fight in the Israeli War of Independence. So very active efforts, and they pay off when they find a message that works.
Vidal Sassoon fought in the 48 war, correct?
Yeah, that was one of the interesting things I ran across. Vidal Sassoon, back before he was an international hair care celebrity, grew up fairly poor, fairly marginalized in London, was affiliated with a number of Zionist groups and anti-fascist groups, and he went off as a British citizen to go fight to help end the British rule of Mandate Palestine and establish the State of Israel. And Vidal Sassoon is actually pretty typical. Most foreign fighters historically just went back to their home countries and reintegrated into normal life. It's more the recent cases with the Islamists since Afghanistan in the 1980s who were not permitted to return home, who ended up with nowhere else to go and started bouncing around from one civil war to another, from Afghanistan to Bosnia and on to Chechnya, Iraq, Algeria, and other places that are in the news today.
Well, are there parallels there, though? Are there parallels that you see with these people and the Muslims from around the world who've joined these wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria?
Well, I think the recruitment message, the pitch, stays pretty much the same. It's always this message that you have a duty to help your group out, that your own government is failing to do it, that you know, you have a personal interest in going off to fight because if our people, whoever they might be, lose this war, they'll come for you next. Same sort of argument that you know, the Americans made about going into Iraq, that if we have to fight them over here so we don't fight them at home. These groups make the same sort of argument in reverse. So that's pretty consistent. The type of individuals that they target seems to be pretty consistent as well. These people, again, who are active in some sort of subculture or subgroup, who happen to know individuals who are already active in the politics of the militant organizations, and the recruiters find them pretty easily. The Internet is starting to play a role. There might be a chance for individuals to go get information, but they still need some sort of recruitment agency to go actually bring them to the fight. So in a lot of ways, things have been pretty consistent for the past two centuries.
Do foreign fighters tend to behave differently in these conflicts than local participants, local fighters?
There are a couple points to that. The foreign fighters actually tend to be more aggressive in recent cases and the historical ones. If you look back at the Iraq War in the last decade, something like 80% of the suicide bombings were conducted by foreign fighters in the country. So they wouldn't seem to be mercenaries. A smart mercenary probably wouldn't blow themselves up. So they are more aggressive. You see this in some of the cases like the Texas Revolution as well, maybe in the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, this is possibly because the individuals who are going are more ideologically motivated. They've been told there's some existential crisis that's do or die. Locals have to worry about protecting their families, their property, their farms, and so they have to protect their own individual interests in a way that the foreigners don't. So one thing that you see happen, the other sort of main factor that shows up with foreign fighters is in pretty much every case, you end up inevitably seeing conflicts erupting between the foreign fighters and the locals who they're supposedly there to protect. The foreign fighters say that the locals aren't fighting hard enough, and the locals think that the foreign fighters are extremists and end up turning away from them. You saw this happen in Iraq a few years ago.
Quickly, we're just about out of time, David, but I've got to ask you, do you feel there's evidence that this phenomenon is on the rise, or is it on the web? On the ebb, I should say.
Well, yeah, sure. It's both. It's not on the ebb, though. The data I got in the that I present in the book, what I've examined from the last couple hundred years, you have basically one in five civil wars in the last 200 years had foreign fighters in them, a pretty high number. The number seems to be on the increase in the last few decades. And more than that, the foreign fighters' insurgencies actually do uncharacteristically well. Most insurgencies only win about a quarter of the time, most rebel groups.
Okay.
The ones with foreign fighters, it's kind of even money.
Okay, very good. David, good conversation. David Mallett's a lecturer in international relations at the University of Melbourne. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the Free Press's John Gallagher talks about what it takes to rebuild and remake a city like Detroit. And we also talk with Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Chairman Aaron Payment about wolves and wolf hunting in Michigan. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com.